Hi, this is Diana Panton. You're listening to 101.5 The Hawk.
You are listening to Bridging the Social Distance. My name is Jenny Mitchell, and I recorded this show here at CFRU, Guelph's campus and community radio station, as a means of creating a platform for us to share ideas and feelings and perspectives in the wake of this global pandemic that is COVID-19. I was afraid that people would get isolated or I would lose the opportunity to chat with my community and find out how everyone is doing, so I made this show. If you're listening and you would like to get involved or be interviewed, you can contact me at mobile@cfru.ca. I'd like to provide the disclaimer that these interviews were recorded at different points in time, so situations in some of these locations may have changed. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Doug Gilmore, a resident over the Village of Riverside Glen Retirement Residence. Doug wrote a book about his life called A Successful Life, Overcoming Adversity with Persistence. This interview was originally recorded on June 9th, 2020. So to start with, can you introduce yourself for listeners?
Well, my name is Doug Gilmore. I was born in Pussnitz Township. Well, not really in Pussnitz Township, in East Flamborough Township, which bordered Pussnitz. I don't think that's so important, other than I'm native to this area. Guelph was, during my early life, our city center. And then as my siblings moved on, most of them moved to Hamilton, and Hamilton became an area that was common to us also. I was born on a farm, and after I married, that was what I began to do. When I lost part of my left arm in a hunting accident, I found that in order to provide for a family, I needed to change careers a little bit. And I was fortunate to acquire work for the township of Pussnitz when it was really a small municipality, small in the sense that it was strictly rural, and began working there as the tax collector. That was the start in 1950. In 1955, I was successful in gaining more employment there, and it was almost a full-time job, and I remained in that position until 1966, when for reasons of my own, I gained employment with Grand River Conservation Authority. When I left there upon retirement in 1990, I was deputy treasurer and office manager, and had a good career, I believe, with Grand River Conservation Authority. I had a fair bit of responsibility, and would have from between 10 to 15 people not fully responsible to me, but at least partially. And I retired from there in, as I said, 1990.
Wow. So something that strikes me is your jobs don't immediately explain your passion or interest in writing. The two don't seem connected. So I am aware that you have written a book about your life. Is that something that you sat down and did later, or were you a person who was keeping journals throughout this time?
No, the reason for writing a book, and I had no intentions of being an author, and I didn't feel I had the capability or the education. I guess it all began because of the fact that my mother died at childbirth just after my 8th birthday. And I had 3 siblings younger than me, and each one of them never remembered my mother. I sensed that they felt that they had missed something, And so I thought, well, I think I'll write down my memories of my mother and give it to my siblings, which I did. And when I say which I did, it sounds like I did it fairly quickly, but it didn't happen quickly. But my wife, Doris, was reading it, and she recommended that I should carry on and include more than just my memories of my mother. And my first cousin, the oldest child of my mother's brother, Alexander Ord, read what I had written about my mother, and he continually kept bothering me, "When are you going to finish your book?" And I think it was through him more than anything else that his continually badgering me, he'd like to read more of my life. And I think that probably began with the close relationship that we in our Gilmore family had with my mother's family. Her maiden name surname was Ord, O-R-D. So I kept writing. And I guess it was after my wife died that I had it almost complete, but didn't have the incentive to carry on and finish writing the whole book. And then my cousin, Don Ord, got after me again. And I started writing again. And with the help of my publisher, I was able to finish it because, to be perfectly frank, I didn't have the technical educational ability or the word processing experience to do a good job of it. So with the help of my publisher and their staff, I was able to provide pictures and have it edited and did complete it. I think I probably finished it in 2010, which was 3 years after my wife's decease.
So when did you write the section about your mother? Was that when you were young or when you were an adult?
No, yeah, I was an adult. I think I probably started writing about 1996 or 97.
Okay.
And I surprised myself because I would just jot down on a piece of paper little things that I remembered about my mother and compiled the first chapter from that. And I surprised myself because along with a few pictures that I put in it, I had 22 pages in the first chapter.
I think it's incredible that, the writing spanned more than 10 years, it's a special amount of time to dedicate to looking back. I sometimes wonder if people that I've met in the senior centers spend as much time reflecting, but you know, as a person who's interested in those stories, I feel like I want to know everything, but I'm not always sure how much time people spend looking back at it, you know?
Well, there are a few reasons for it to take longer. First of all, you had to depend on your memory. And then I had to learn word processing. And then I had to do all my typing with one hand. So you don't type very fast. You make a few errors. And you go back and forth, and you correct. And then I had no training in typing. I the only way I could accomplish it was to memorize the keyboard. Remember where the alphabet was, and do it that way. Actually, I learned to type when I was clerk treasurer of the Township of Postlage, just by memorizing the keyboard and be able to type up the agendas and the mail and so on. So that was a good sense of self-training when I decided to write the book.
So do you think that this type of autobiographical writing helps with the memory? Like, do you feel like you have more memories because of the time you've spent documenting it? And did any memories kind of come up as you were writing that you had forgotten about?
Well, no, I think it went the other way around, because when I had written about my mother, then I had a few experiences in the elementary school that had a profound effect on me. And I think, in due respect to everyone, I enjoyed what education I got in elementary school, which was a rural one-room school. But I was in an area where the caste system was prevalent. And sometimes you had to struggle to really fit in, because I was not part of the original system. Mm. When I say that, I say it with great respect. It was an area which was settled mainly by Scottish settlers, and it was a successful in their own right in their native land, and they came and took up land in this area and were self-sufficient, whereas my parents were, my grandparents were illiterate, and they came and settled in the same area, partially as outsiders, you might say. Now, I hope I'm telling it truthfully, because I don't believe that the original residents felt that way. I think they felt they were really including us. But unfortunately, I fell into the same type of role, where as I was accepted, then I was maybe looked down on some of the other people that came and were not just quite the same as the original settlers. So I experienced that, but I also reacted to it in a way of which I regret. So I think that made me more aware of the difference in the system, even though most of the people I knew at the time would deny that it existed.
Interesting.
So I wanted to reveal some of that unfairness, but not just the unfairness, the problems that people that weren't well educated had, what they suffered, and the ignorance. I didn't want to display it vividly, but I wanted to display it as it appeared to me, and hopefully the reader would recognize it. And then once I got past that, I felt I needed to identify some of the inadequacies in my own disposition and how I looked on the world. And it's only as you uncover some of these events and start to write about them that you recognize them within yourself. And I'll have to slow down a little bit, because as I get into some of the other things that affected my life and initiated my writing, I might become a little bit emotional. I think what created the desire in me to write was when my eldest son became ill with a mental illness. I won't name it. It's not a good name. And I felt I had to reveal some of the ways that affects not just the ill person, but his caregivers and his parents. So I wrote about that. Not always with the support of those around me, because what you have to be conscious of is how is the ill person going to react to this being on paper for others that they knew or know would be able to read. How is it going to affect them? And getting on to something that's maybe easier to talk about, I'm very proud of the fact that I was able to rehabilitate myself after losing my arm. And so I recorded the emotions that you had as you started to fit yourself back into your community and become independent. I think as I continued writing, I formed the opinion that I had something to tell people, that misfortune or tragedy is not necessarily the end of the world. There's still life ahead. And I tried to live that in my rehabilitation after losing an arm. And then from that, I felt that the world didn't end when my son became ill. It made it a little more difficult to handle. We had to learn new ways to overcome challenge. And then Doris and I lost our second daughter to cancer at age 56, which was devastating. But the only one that lost life was our daughter. We didn't lose ours. We were still living. We had each other. So I guess to put it in another fashion, during this time of COVID-19, when we're restricted in our movement and in our activities, the recreational staff here had encouraged residents to write or say something that they felt that would help us through this time of trouble. And so they had residents put a little slogan on a heart that they had shaped, and they would set it up on the windows and the hallways and so on to encourage each and every one of us. And the one that that really impressed me was the one that said, "The caterpillar thought the world was ending, and then it turned into a butterfly."
That's really beautiful. How old were you when you had the accident where you lost part of your arm?
I was 23 years old.
Wow, that's a young man. Do you think, it was really beautiful, your depiction of sort of trying to figure out how you fit, or like how to go back into your community and what that looks like when, you know, you have to recover, that there is a life to live and to contribute to. Do you think in a way having a really significant life situation like that as a young man has made you stronger for challenges that came later? You know, compared to maybe some people that you share space with now that maybe loss came a lot later for them. Or that kind of tragedy maybe didn't happen until they were at a later point in their life. Do you sense that there was a sort of strength or perspective gained by that happening at that young age?
Well, I can think of two or three things. I can't put them in any ranked order, but I will relate them. One, and this is getting back to the community in which we lived and the people in which we lived, where I indicated that there was a caste system prevalent in the school, and that I don't want to leave a picture that is distasteful. I don't intend it to be. But I would like to emphasize that the same community got behind me 100%, not only physically, but financially. I played on the local ball team, and we were popular in the community. And every ball team and every one in the community contributed money to help pay for my hospital expenses and things like that. So that gives you a fuller picture of the type of community in which I lived. The other thing was, I was acquainted with two people that lived close by that had lost part of their arm. One gentleman, I always wondered how in the world he managed, but he was very independent and very capable, and he managed and he went about his daily activities just as if he always had two arms. The other gentleman that I knew complained quite a bit. And I thought, well, first of all, I was curious. I was very curious. I wondered how artificial arms worked. So I was curious to find out. And the other thing is, another part of my makeup is that I'm going to say I was independent, but my children and my wife would say, that's not quite right. You were as stubborn as a mule. And they are correct. So I was determined that I would make it work. Mm. I could overcome this. So every opportunity I got, I spoke to people that I knew had prosthesis. I always use the term artificial arm because I think that explains more than prosthesis if you really don't know what the word means. So I didn't qualify for financial assistance to get a prosthesis, and yet people knew that there were sources that you could touch, and there was an organization in Guelph. I do not remember the name, but they were helpful in giving me access to, it was a hospital in London, Ontario, that was doing prosthesis at the time. And they somehow managed to convince the hospital there to provide me with a prosthesis.
Wow.
At no cost to me.
That's amazing.
It was made abundantly clear that this would only be the first prosthesis, and that any need afterwards would be my own financial responsibility. And yet at that time, I just thought that once you got a prosthesis, you got a prosthesis, and it would likely last indefinitely. However, it wasn't very long before I realized that they broke and needed repaired quite frequently, especially at the time, that time, because I was still farming. And it was work that wore them out quickly. Now, where were we? How was I trying to answer your question?
Well, I mean, you touched on a point in there that resonated with me, which was, I think my original question was around whether, you know, recovering from a tragedy early in life made you more resilient or you know, more steady or ready to take on challenges later. A point that you made that was really beautiful was when you saw your community come together to support you. And it is interesting. It seemed sort of like something that now that you're in Riverside Glen and you're seeing how the folks working there are working to support you through this kind of serious situation that is a global pandemic. Sometimes it takes a tragedy or an unfortunate situation to really highlight just how prepared to support you your community is. Like, it's a nice thought that maybe our community cares that much all the time, but there's not always as clear an example to prove that to you or give you that acknowledgement of it until there's a crisis that they really come out and shine in.
I think one of the reasons that I was found I was going to be normal again. I was the catcher for a local ball team when I lost my arm. And incidentally, my brother was the pitcher. And we had decent success. And that team, after I lost my arm, with my brother pitching and others in the community, was successful in winning several rural championship medals. But I can't say whether it was because of the community example or not, or because of the fact that I enjoyed the job, but I made up my mind I was going to rehabilitate. And I vowed I was going to catch ball sometime. And I did.
Amazing.
I had a prosthesis, and I had the lower end of it hand fashioned by a local blacksmith to fit into a baseball glove. And I practiced with it, and I did catch for the local ball team for part of an inning just to prove that I could. But that was really a minor. I think the most difficult probably was using the prosthesis in the farm work, and it doesn't work like your real arm. You have to learn how to use it as a prosthesis, and it can be very, very, very useful. I was disappointed very much in my first prosthesis because the people that designed it knew I was a farmer, and they didn't recommend a full prosthesis. And what I mean by full prosthesis is one that has an elbow and also a hook or a claw or a connection that you can use as a hand. Mm-hmm. I decided when I was getting a prosthesis that if a hand, an artificial hand, was only going to be appealing as a hand and not an efficient use that I would do without, if it was going to be for appearance only, I didn't want it. I had to have something that I could usefully use. And they told me that for the type of work that I was doing, there was two disadvantages to an elbow prosthesis. The first was that you needed another strap around your body in order to operate it, and you needed a strap to operate the hand or the claw. So you're going to have two straps around your body, and you're activating them by the way you moved your body or your shoulder.
Okay.
If I wanted to open the claw on my left hand, there was a strap and went around and under my right armpit, and I would just move my shoulder like this, and then the prosthesis claw would open.
Oh, okay.
And I was going to have to do something like that, too, to activate the elbow joint. So the double strap around my body, they didn't recommend in order to operate the elbow. And secondly, the elbow joints were prone to breakage in the heavy work that I was doing. And I found that accurate because I was always breaking some of the straps that opened and closed the fingers that I was using in the claw. So I took their recommendation that I do not have an elbow. So it meant my left arm was shorter than my right. And so it really wasn't a good appearance of an artificial arm getting you back to the way you were. Mm-hmm. So I overcame that. I just said, well, this is the way it's going to be. This is the way I'm going to look from now on, and made it do.
You're listening to Bridging the Social Distance, a show recorded here in Guelph at CFRU as a platform for sharing stories and perspectives during the global pandemic of COVID-19. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Doug Gilmore, a resident over at the Village of Riverside Glen Retirement Residence. I'm picking up on a sort of theme. And when you described earlier that your family would describe you as stubborn, and when you were describing the story of setting out to be a catcher again, you know, and getting a blacksmith to manipulate your prosthesis to make that possible, it feels like there's a bit of a pattern of you being driven by the very thing that is in your path, like that the overcoming it is a huge motivator to sort of make that extra stride. And I'm curious what your life would have been like without those obstacles. You know, if you would have gone looking for challenges or things to overcome if they hadn't presented themselves.
Well, that's interesting. I'd have probably, well, to a certain extent, I experience something that drives me here. And I don't want to say something that's going to put people down, but they will remain private. But I see there's places that where people give up, and it's maybe unfair for me to say that, because in later years my wife suffered with dementia, and in some ways she gave up too. But she gave up because she didn't know any better. She couldn't. She didn't have the capacity, because of her illness, to identify reality and know that, yes, I've got to do this. I've got to do that. I've got to be able to do it. I've got to keep this back. And I find that, to a certain extent, in some of the residents, where because of their aging or the way it affects their mind or the body as they age, and I can accept that, but I can't accept it when they've got their full senses and they don't try. You can accomplish so much. Can you see my fingernails?
See which? Fingernails? No. Can you hold them up higher?
You don't need to see them. I trim my own fingernails.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
That's awesome.
Well, I surprise a lot of people.
Yeah.
Well, there are ways of doing it. And I must sound as though I'm bragging, because it's not easy.
No, that's actually...
It's not easy. And it takes a long time. It'll take me 2 hours to do my fingernails.
Wow.
And the reason it'll do that is because I have to do a lot of filing. I have to use what I have on my left arm to hold it over a file on a counter. Sometimes I have to sit down and rest after I do two. But I can do it. And what drove me to that? Well, It was easy to ask my wife to do it. But after she was having trouble remembering and doing things properly, if you use those squeeze snippers, I don't know what the name of them are, but if you don't hold them steady and straight, and you have a little difficulty squeezing them to snip your finger, and you turn them down, first thing you know, the bottom blade is in too far, and you've nipped this under skin. And that happened a time or two, where she nipped the under skin on me. But after she died, I thought, now who's going to do it? So I learned to do it myself.
I can't help but feel like that's something that the staff there would be willing to help with. Is there a specific reason why you feel so driven to continue to be independent with that task, even when you don't have to be anymore?
No, I don't think so. I'll just give you a little example. I was looking after my own medication. And incidentally, my oldest daughter is a nurse. And she suggested that when I'm here, you should let the nurses administer medication. And finally, I agreed. And so I was relieved of a few things, well, several things. Number one, I had to keep track of when I needed refills of medication. Number two, I had to order it. Number three, I had to go and pick it up. Number four, I had to arrange it so that I was taking it at the prescribed time and I was taking it the right quantities. That was a chore I had to do. But in the morning when I got up, I knew where my medication was. I knew what I had to take. I got up and I took it. And then I went and went for a walk outside before breakfast. But now I have to wait until the nurse comes around. And then for obvious reasons, they're attending to a lot of other people, so maybe it took a little longer. I'm very happy with how it has been administered, but I didn't used to have to wait at all. Mm-hmm. No, for a little bit. I think I have the attitude, if I can do it myself, why should I bother somebody else? Or why should I have to wait for somebody else who is busy with the person down the hall that needs attention more or quicker than I do? I'm able to do it. Why would I take up somebody else's time when I'm able to do it myself? I guess I'm impatient, and my children know that. I'm sorry.
I think you can describe that as impatience, but I feel like I really understand. I have a lot of similar things that I've learned to do purely because if I can do them myself or I can do them at home, it just means I can move on to something more exciting, more valuable to me quicker than setting aside a whole block to schedule for, you know, what could just be a small thing that I could just accomplish and move on. And I think, like, living in Riverside Glen and maybe being having fewer and fewer things that you are specifically personally responsible for, it probably kind of reframes or re-centers you in your own kind of independence to be administering some of your own tasks that way. It's the stuff that brings you back to what you're capable of. And so it seems like it's almost like you implementing a little bit of resistance to overcome that, to sort of refresh and have it back in your own hands, so to speak. It makes sense to me. I think, like, if people, you know, Well, if people living where you live, like, gave over all of the tasks of independence, how do you keep a sense of what you're capable of, or, like, your own kind of identity in that?
Well, it's difficult. And gradually, you have to look inward. You have to examine some things a little more closely. I had to admit to my wife, yes, maybe we should leave the farm. Maybe we should go somewhere where there's not as much work for you or for me. And you have to assess your own capability and come to a decision. Yes, we have to change. So we did. We did go and lived in a condominium in Guelph, actually, it was just across the road from here. Mm-hmm. I used to come here and visit friends of mine, from the community, that weren't having. Well, I was going to say weren't having a lot of company. I don't know whether they were or not. But I would come to visit them because I felt that they probably would like to talk to somebody on their own terms. There were fellow farmers or neighbors or things like that. So I would come here and visit them. I opposed coming to a retirement place, I think mainly because of my independence and the confidence I had in myself. And I was coming home from visiting a relative that lived in the States. My younger daughter and I were driving, and she broached the subject, Dad, did you ever think that maybe you should be living in a retirement home? And this was when I was about 12 or 15 years younger than I am. And my answer to her was, well, I said, I thought I would think about that when I turned 85. Oh, she says, what's magic about it being 85? Well, I said, I don't think there's anything magic about being 85, but my dad lived to be pretty independent and lived to be 96, and I thought that probably at age 85 I should think about me not always being in good health, and I should think of alternative places to live. So she said, well, maybe you should do it sooner. But no, I persevered, and at 85 years old, I started looking at retirement homes, and I looked at three and did a bit of an analysis of them and had my own conclusions made. And the village of Riverside Glen was pretty high on the list. Besides that, as I had indicated before, I had visited people that were living here, and a gentleman who used to do my car maintenance and repair was living here. I would come over and visit him every Thursday, and we would play three or four games of cribbage. So I got to know the place pretty well. But it took her coaxing, when I say her, I mean my youngest daughter, Susan, a bit of coaxing, for I lived for 9 years independent in the condominium. I had learned to cook, I thought, adequate for my wife and I when I had to start cooking to help her out then. I thought it was adequate until I came here, and I found that the meals that we were eating when we were living alone were maybe not quite as fully sufficient to fill our needs as what I'm getting here. And I'm not degrading them. I enjoyed and liked what I cooked, but the only trouble was my wife didn't always like as well what I cooked as I liked. So that complicated my cooking when she was living. Didn't complicate it as much when she passed away, because then I just cooked the meals I liked. Now, I'm lost in thought again. How did we get to be talking about this subject?
Well, I think that narrative came off of that. Sometimes I guess you have to make the decision to, I guess, accept help or move somewhere, even if nothing specific happens to provoke it, even if it is just picking an age or picking a point. I think because I pointed out how much seems to be framed around you facing resistance or facing struggles and overcoming them, but in some cases you've had to make big decisions just because you've had to. There isn't necessarily a specific thing that a moment that provokes it and is super clear, but
I can think of a couple of things that provoke if I had to make them real. I would, in the last 7 years when I was doing all the cooking for myself, I did eat out. I ate most lunches at the senior center on Walway Street. I would go to a restaurant. I always ate my own breakfast. I ate at the senior center at lunch and would go occasionally to a restaurant. But I would make up large quantities of the food that I liked and then freeze it in meal-sized quantities in the freezer. So I had adequate food available to me. I think there were two things that finally made me decide. Making a large quantity of food and freezing it, it isn't just the making, it's the cleaning up afterwards. And that can get a little bit tiresome. And I was thinking, well, how many more years can I continue doing this before I move on? And then an opening came here one April. Incidentally, I had my name in here for 5 years, as I had in two other places. And as an opening came, I decided it wasn't quite recent. In April of 2017, an opening came, and I came and looked at it, brought my granddaughter, got my daughter, my son with me. I decided it wasn't in the area I wanted, and I wasn't quite ready. And then my daughter's husband came and talked to me, and he didn't put any pressure on me, but he asked me some questions that how I would manage in these circumstances and so on, and made me think. And so I came back and said to Liz, was one of them, Liz Sikorsky, if there is another opening comes up, let me know about it. And then an opening came up for the room I'm in now. And I thought about how I was feeling about, well, how long am I really going to enjoy cleaning up after I make my meals and freeze it? And thought about the questions that my son-in-law had asked me. And I said, well, now's the time. And so I spoke to Liz again, and we made arrangements to move in here in July of 2017. So now I'll soon be here for a few years.
So. Wow. I want to ask a couple questions since we're almost at an hour. There are two questions I've been asking pretty much everybody that I've interviewed. And one of those questions is what support could look like. So I get the impression that you do feel well supported where you are, but I wonder if just from knowing what's going on with other people in your life, or maybe knowing some of the ways that you are supported that other folks don't have access to, if there's something that you could share that strikes you as a good way to show support during a time like this, maybe for the seniors in your life, but maybe there's a different route for that question, but...
Well, I think that the Village of Riverside Glen has provided wonderful support. I do miss the intergenerational, well, not intergenerational, just the mixing with other adults that we had available to us before the pandemic. But I understand why it is necessary, and the controls and providing activities evolve gradually, as did knowledge of the pandemic. So that's not criticism, it's just how it evolved. But your question really was there anything that I needed it? And the answer is no, but I need to make that explain why I don't feel the need. Number one, I have a large family, and I have email, and I have Skype, even though I couldn't get it working for this interview today. But it, and so I can talk to my daughter in Florida and see each other on Skype. But and I'm also a member of Facebook. And being from a large family, at last count, I can't name all the relatives I have in this area, but coming from a large family, I have, last count, I have 22 nieces and 17 nephews, and they all have families of their own. So we have a huge contact, and many of them wanted to befriend me on Facebook. So I have all kinds of things like that to keep me busy. I like to read. I like to walk, but I can't walk as much as I would like because I'm not able to anymore. And I think I had some other things down here. Oh, yeah. I have a friend here that is very hard of hearing, and his hearing aids weren't working, but I was able to convince him to let me help me. And by contacting his hearing aid professional, which was the same one that I was using, I was able to take his hearing aids from him, leave them at the entrance that is staffed as you go in and out, have them picked up, taken back to the hearing aid professional, repaired, and brought back the same day. They let me know they were there. The staff took them to him, and lo and behold, he could make the waitresses hear. The waitresses could make him hear that night at dinner time. So there's little things like that. Here they've provided someone to do my toiletry shopping once a month, and I have across-the-counter prescriptions that I use that I don't get refilled by the medic. Professional. So there's been people to do that for me. Initially, my daughter had it do me for the first time and leave it at the door. So I don't really have any real need with Facebook and reading. The few programs I still like that are available on the TV. There are still programs available, curling, provided you can participate with distancing, but it does decrease the number of people that can participate in them. There's shuffleboard, there's bingo, that is still available, and they've altered their routine in order to keep it still available, but with safe distancing.
Well, I think we're pretty much out of time. The other question I like to ask people is one around silver linings. So something that you've seen happening during this time that can be seen as a positive, even despite the kind of, you know, the severity of a global pandemic, not suggesting that this isn't a really intense and hard time, but is there something you've experienced during this time that you think is actually a positive experience? I guess maybe it's all the things you mentioned, in a way.
Well, if I was to think of two things that were positive, and you maybe cannot identify them immediately, but they will be positive, is first of all, it made us more aware of our, I can't find the right word, I'm going to use inadequacies, but that's not the word I would rather use. It made us more aware of our lack of control. We have control over ourselves, but we don't always have control over what is going on in the world. And in making us aware of our own inadequacies, it maybe makes us more aware of the fact that we need to be more considerate of each other. But there's something else. Yes, the other thing is it makes us really appreciate the friends that we have and that we're missing now.
I love that.
I think that sums it up.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. I really appreciate it. I love being given a glimpse into the lives of folks that I don't get to meet in person right now. So thank you for being willing to chat with me.
Well, thank you. You're very, very polite. I hope I don't come off as being too stubborn. I like to use the word determined.
I think that's a perfect summary.
Thank you, Jen.
So once again, that was Doug Gilmore, a resident over at the Village of Riverside Glen Retirement Residence. He wrote a book about his life called A Successful Life, Overcoming Adversity with Persistence. That brings us to the end of this episode of Bridging the Social Distance, a show produced at CFRU in Guelph and syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario, that aims to create a platform for us sharing what we are doing to get through this time together in the wake of COVID-19.
Broadcasting across the Steel City, this is 101.5 The Hawk.
Avertis, plusieurs personnes sont allées cacher leur famille dans un ravin. D'autres, dans un endroit que l'on appelle encore si beau sec. Et d'autres sont restés. Dans la nuit, le major Roger et ses hommes ont bondi dans le village. Ils ont brûlé toutes les maisons, à l'exception de trois, parce que c'est là qu'on conservait le maïs pour nourrir les gens durant l'hiver. Ils ont tué beaucoup de monde.
Paris.